Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Westgate versus State.
May it please the court, Mr. John McLeish will defend arguments for petitioners. Mr. McLeish has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John McLeish. I'm with Carroll Tower. I have had the privilege of representing Westgate when we did in the lower courts. The evidence there is that Westgate was owned principally and operated by two experienced, historically successful developers who were brought to the brink of financial ruin by this project and the state's actions in it, and you have been left there by what we perceive as the Court of Appeals' misconception about the scope of the cause of action under Texas law for inverse condemnation. I think it's relatively well settled now that an inverse condemnation occurs without the initiation of a formal proceeding and without the payment of compensation. The government physically enters a landowner's property or physically deprives him of his access. Or in the alternative, they take acts in furtherance of public good that unreasonably interfere with the landowner's use and enjoyment of his property. This is not a physical taking case. It's undisputed in the lower courts that physical possession of the property was never taken. They never closed off the landowner's driveway at the relevant time. The issue for the court to decide, I think, is whether within the context of the definition, the acts of the government in this case constituted such an unreasonable interference with the owner's use and enjoyment of his property, with his investment-backed expectations, to borrow the words of the Supreme Court, so as to trigger the obligation of the government to pay pay damages for the owner's loss.
And on that specific question, there's no direct authority in this state. You've argued some cases that you say show that it should go that way, but there's no direct authority that just squarely holds that. Is that true?
There is no direct authority on this exact fact situation, Your Honor. I think it's factually very close to the City of Austin and Teague. I think that the distinctions that have been drawn in the lower courts between this case and the City of Austin and Teague are distinctions that make no legal difference. But I am not going to stand here and tell you that this case is the same as Teague, because I don't think it is. I think it's also very close to Avenue Restaurant and the holdings that the court set out there. I think the one step away from Avenue Restaurant that this case goes is to say we recognize a cause of action where the government acts illegally, negligently, or unduly delays in the building of the roadway. We're going to hold that the planning and the right-of-way acquisition is just as much a part of that, and they have the same duty of liability. And
What is the rule in other jurisdictions?
Your Honor, the rules are as varied as the fact scenarios that give rise to the cause of action that you may get.
Are there cases outside this state which would rather squarely hold in your favor in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court of Alaska, in a recent case, has cited in both the amicus briefs that have been filed on behalf of the landlords in this case, has squarely held that the delays involved between the time that the project is announced and the time that the land is finally taken, those delays are compensable to the landowner where he can show his use of his property was unreasonably interfered with and that he suffered damages by that.
And besides that one, are there other cases?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. Louisiana has such a holding that is directly on point. I should point out to the court in fairness and in candor, the Louisiana Constitution is a little bit different than ours in that it does not order the governmental entity that's taken the property to make the, I mean, it does not order them to pay out of the compensation. It orders them to make the landowner whole. And the Louisiana Supreme Court has held that that means they've got to pay the landowner any damages of any kind whatsoever. I think the United States Supreme Court decision, the First Lutheran decision out of California, is factually very close. Not insofar as they denied the landowner the right to build anything, but insofar as in this case they denied the landowners the right to use what they had built. There are a number of decisions that are factually close to this, most of them involving urban renewal. It's very difficult, because of the peculiar facts of this case, to find one that is dead on point.
Well, to adopt your position, to take the other side of the ledger, will it be necessary for us or desirable for us to disapprove or overrule some existing Texas precedent?
The case that comes closest, I think, to being on point on the other side of my side of this case is the City of Houston and Biggers. I don't think this court has to do anything with the Biggers decision. That was a case where the landowner was subject to a condemnation for a long time, and after the jury verdict, the government didn't like it and dismissed the case. The court held, the Court of Appeals held in this court, NRE, the decision, that they could do that without paying the landowner any compensation. Just as soon as the legislature could get back into session, Justice Mosley and some of the other people up there got a bill passed that made it mandatory for the government to pay compensation in that situation. That bill remains on in the property code essentially unchanged today. And I don't think that you have to overrule the Biggers, as I don't have a case that's directly on my side of this case. At this point, I don't think there's one that's directly on the other side. I think that the cases are distinguishable on both sides of the docket.
So we're basically riding on not necessarily a clean slate because it's against the background of these cases, but we're filling in a gap in the law that you feel has not been addressed previously.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I'm a condemnation lawyer, and I think that some of the members of the court may know that I've been up here on inverse cases before. The way these work is that there are points on a graph where the court says this is a taking and this is not. And cases that are factually similar, when a trial judge gets a case like this, he analyzes this one, and he analyzes this one where there wasn't a taking and tries to find the line. It's not a bright line. I wish I had a bright line test, a better test than reasonable, unreasonable interference to offer you, but it's a very wide-ranging cause of action. It's been applied to a lot of different fact scenarios, and there's really not one. I'm here to argue that you should drive a peg today. You should put a survey stake in the pay compensation side of the ledger to guide trial courts and condemnors and tell them when they treat a landowner this way that they've got to pay compensation.
Counsel, you're about out of time and the facts are in your brief, but briefly can you give me a global view of who did what and who and when?
Very, very quickly as I can do it, as succinct as I can do it, Your Honor. My clients, as well as several others in this area, planned commercial development along the road, not knowing that it was going to be changed into a freeway. I don't think there's any doubt that they had any knowledge of this until October of 1985 when the public announcement happened. There's no doubt that the state had knowledge of it. The state and the city changed memos about it, talked about whether they should warn landowners along the road, and decided not to. The week that my clients finished the outside of their shopping center, public announcement was made. They went down to the highway department and they showed them that map that has been introduced into the evidence of State Exhibit 3 and is before you as Exhibit B. And you can see they flew the aerials before my clients built anything on their property. That's the Westgate property on top. Trial evidence was that the lines were put on there showing where the right-of-way lines were before they poured their slag. In early 1986, my clients learned that it was going to be some time before the acquisition would occur. They were totally unable to lease the space in Building B and sell that path where the line goes through, as you may be able to imagine. They went to the Highway Department, got a determination of a hardship. That means the Highway Department found, based on the evidence the landowners gave them, that they were suffering financial injury unique to them because of the public project, and they promised them early acquisition. That was in July of 1986. The acquisition did not occur until January of 1989, and the jury rejected apparently what explanation the government had, but it's interesting to note the Barton Ridge property across the street was not a hardship condemnation. It was a protective acquisition where the government caught this project in time before they got anything built, recognized that it could minimize its costs in acquiring this lander, and they went out and initiated the condemnation proceeding, and even though they didn't close the transaction until April of 1986, it was evidence in trial, undisputed evidence in trial. They got the landowner paying on February 27th of 1986. This is not an isolated incident. The trial evidence also showed that there were seven other protective acquisitions where the government initiated the acquisition either by purchase or by condemnation to protect its own interests. All of those were acquired in 1986, or within the first 3 days, first 3 months of 1987. My clients were the first hardship property where the landowner's injury was recognized to be acquired.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Barney Knight will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, although I strongly disagree that we're here on a clean slate, rather than me drawn into that issue of discussing the great weight of the law and the great volume of the law, in circumstances far past this, in which this court and many others have said there is no compensable taking, I want to address some public policy issues presented by this case to this court. This grant of writ of error presents significant public policy concerns that can only be avoided if this court again affirms that actual and real interference with access or use of property is required rather than and as opposed to potential or perceived interference with access or use.
So that is if the condemnor waited 20 years to condemn the property, there would simply be no recourse.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue has been set, that property has been sitting there since time immemorial waiting to be condemned. The city or the state took absolutely no action against this property prior to filing the condemnation proceedings.
But they announced that they was going to be condemned and then waited a relatively long time to proceed.
In response to that, Your Honor, the public hearing process, the legislative process, which this court and others have said, the planning and laying out of highways is a legislative process. It's subject to those open meeting notices, those announcements that we're going to consider this process. They had to announce. It was required. It's part of the public decision-making process in this state. Nobody has said there was a final decision to be made, that would be made here. And in this case, in that regard, since we talked about the evidence, the one expert in this case that was put on by petitioners with respect to the time required testified that it would take at minimum, at best was his terms, 3 to 5 years from the date of announcement, October 20th, 1985 in this case, to begin taking property.
But the parcel
in this case was taken 3 years and 2 months after the date of announcement.
But your position is, even if it had taken 20 years, it would still not be a compensable taking.
The planning of roadways, transportation systems, parks, etc. in this state has been encouraged by public policy, judicial precedent, statute. There's plans all over this state with projects setting on them, waiting for a specific need to arise, waiting for funding to come up, etc. That was de facto what was in place here. It had come up, said, okay, now we think we're going to have some federal funds to do this project with. We go and comply with all these federal and state regulations. We start hearing this process. If we're to be responsible for the cost to open government in this state, to people being concerned about what a bill is pending at the state legislature and otherwise, it's going to be a pretty heavy impact on public policy.
So the answer is, no matter how long, it would not be a compensable taking.
In my personal opinion, from all reading as much law as I could read on this point over the last 15 years, we're at the meeting place between
Can we just get an answer to this question?
I'm sorry?
If it took 20 years, length of time would give rise to a cause of action?
Yes, to answer your question, if there had been no action more than was in this case.
No, sir. I just want to know, as a matter of law, is there any amount of delay that would give rise to compensable taking?
In some fact situations, yes, sir. In this case, though, with nothing except legislative consideration to consider whether we're going to build a project or not.
What would be one of those factual situations?
I think one of those fact situations, for example, is if you started condemnation on a property and then waited 10 years to take it.
Because of funding
Funding issues or whatever. I think that the courts have addressed that over a period of years. You can then allow enhancement up through that 10 years rather than the earlier. That's the way you handle it statutorily. condemnation proceedings. Is to answer the question specifically, the meeting point of the police powers and inverse condemnation is that absent actual material and substantial interference with access or use, there's immunity because it's a police power regulation. When you cross that line, when you interfere with the actual, when you substantially and materially interfere with the access or use of the property, then you have committed an action that results in inverse condemnation.
Well, does it have to be physical, Bob? That's...
No, it can be as in Teague. There can be a denial of a permit, but the courts of this state in Teague recognized it. What they did in Teague, they tried to put a servitude on the property at the sole cost of that property owner with no sharing of the cost amongst the general public. That's exactly contrary to what we have here. The city, they gave them all their permits. The public was prepared to expend large sums of money on this project, and here they're asking for damages that this court and others, the U.S. Supreme Court and all others, have held to be merely incidental and non-compensable.
Counsel, just a question of basic fairness, reasonableness. Looking at the charts over there, if the Barton Ridge property was moved on earlier within an early time period, an early framework in this condemnation process and in the planning construction for this highway, and the Westgate property was issued permits and allowed to continue with their construction without any significant or real notice of this project, where's the reasonable standard? Where's the fairness standard? What's the rationale for saying, okay, we're going to go ahead and preempt, we're going to do some preventive work, we're going to take this Barton Ridge property early so we don't run up our costs. We'll let Westgate go ahead, we'll issue them the permits, we'll let them invest a lot of money, and then effectively deprive them of the use of the property and diminish their property value because the law protects us and we can hide behind it and we don't have to pay the piper for it. I don't understand that line of reasoning.
I think the issue there is the courts have always held that the timing of acquisition, the decision to which properties to acquire, are legislative, and the courts will not interfere in that or second guess that. And
still
to get one step further to answer your fairness question. In this case, the other properties, the property comparably, they took the good faith offer. If you start requiring in a project like this, the record reflects that both US 183 and 290 were being constructed or ongoing across both ends of Austin from one side of town to the other. Major projects like that must necessarily be constructed in phases. They require the acquisitions of hundreds of parcels. If you are not allowed to schedule and acquire based on need, as the courts have allowed in the past, the cost, the public cost of scheduling, responding, the time required to construct projects.
This isn't on the other side of town. It's right across the street. This is the phase that you were acquiring property in right here at that time.
Okay. The issue being is this would have acquired condemnation. They refused the good faith, voluntary offer to purchase.
This is before construction?
Hmm?
This is before construction?
No, it was after construction, the offer and purchase.
So Westgate refused your good faith offer?
Yes, there was an offer to purchase.
Barton Ridge
accepted
it.
Yes, sir.
And so by refusing your so-called good faith offer, then you could delay condemnation proceedings as long as you want to until they went belly up.
I think that's not what the intent was here at all. The intent was you have literally hundreds of parcels that have to be condemned. This was not the first phase of this project. You start back and condemn so you can efficiently spend the public monies and the funding you have and the time and the scheduling resources you have. To have hundreds of parcels to be acquired and allow individual property owners at random to require you to take their property out of order or one out of a phase that may be constructed 2 or 3 years from that day presents significant cost to the public.
What was the time frame from the time of the taking of the Barton Ridge property the time of the taking of the Westgate property? And what kind of notice were the Westgate owners given
that their property was in line to be taken. In other words, I want to know the timetable. Was Barton Ridge taken well in advance of the time that a move was made on the Westgate property? Were they allowed to go ahead and obtain permits from one of the condemning authorities to construct something that was going to be useless to them, and in fact was going to part of which was going to have to be torn down during the time that all this was being contemplated, and in fact you were condemning property across the street?
There are about three points to that. My recollection, and I'd have to refer to the record itself, is the Barton Ridge property was acquired sometime in mid-1986, about the time the parties here requested condemnation and subsequently turned down the offer that was made. Secondly, the permits for a development of this property, which is a separate regulatory issue, took place and the permits were issued. The administrative approval of that development was completed before this issue was ever on the agenda of the City Council in February 1985. There's no basis the staff that was doing this had any knowledge of that this was a budding and growing legislative issue that would be considered at that point in time when they issued these permits. What happened in this case is they came in, they got the permits, they built their shopping center. It cost the state and the city and the federal government a fair amount of dollars because they had built those improvements. And under Teague, they had no choice, even if they had known about it, unless they had the money to buy it at the time, but to issue the permits. They came in right at a crack in the process before the legislative process started to actually see if they were going to build the process, got the permits, started construction, got it completed. And it was completed about the same time as the first public announcement of the project, well before any right-of-way line had been established, well before the City Council or anybody else had said, amen, this is the right-of-way line we're going to take.
Mr. Knight, I'm still confused about your response to a question that I think is important, and we're just as damaged as that. Did the city know of this project? I'm talking about the highway. At the time it issued the permit to build this building, did it have any duty to inform the other people? I mean, the owners, the investors of the project. Look, this not may not be a very good idea. We've got a highway coming through it.
Firstly, I cannot find any evidence in the record that they did know at the time they issued the permit. The permit application was made in November 1984. It was administratively approved in December 1984 by the city staff as one that could be administratively approved. The record reflects also that what happened is they approved it and said, before we actually hand it to you and you can start work, you've got to get this issue with your water and sewer, or you're going to get water and sewer resolved. They spent several months getting that water and sewer service resolved. Came in and said, we've got our water and sewer service, here's your permit. Permit was issued and actually handed to them in March. The first meeting of the City Council, where this was on the agenda of the City Council in the City of Austin, was in February of 1985.
That may have been true with reference to right-of-way acquisition, but wasn't it already in the Austin Transportation Plan?
Yes, Your Honor. It was in the Austin Transportation Plan, and they knew about the Austin Transportation Plan, and this court has said very specifically that information which may be obtained by reasonable examination of the public record, you're under constructive notice of it, and there's an irrebuttable presumption of actual notice.
Well, I understood that to be the city's position in this case, I thought.
Yes, sir.
And I guess the question is then, in response to Justice Gonzalez, if they were charged with notice of it, why wasn't the city charged with notice of it also, in terms of advising them that the place they were about to erect the building be in was going to be in the middle of a highway?
The plan was setting there, as are a lot of comprehensive plans. The issue being that at that critical point in time, no one knew that this plan was really about to become an implementable project, one that was about to start up. It was on the plan. If we're put under a burden to advise people of all the projects that are listed on comprehensive plans around the state, are we going to be put on a burden and pay damages every time we don't voluntarily go forth and advise people, investors, sophisticated investors, of all the issues contained in the public records and documents which may in the future cause them harm?
And government has no obligation for the right hand to know what the left hand is doing. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. I'm saying that are we going to put the burden on the public here of paying damages because these sophisticated investors did not stop and look at any comprehensive plans, although their architect testified he knew about the plan? Is the public going to be held responsible for paying those damages, or are we going to let the investor take responsibility for his own
actions? Is it unreasonable for a prospective builder to assume that if the city issues a permit, if the government issues a permit for construction in this area, that those plans are not going to be proceeded with? Why in the world would any reasonable governmental entity issue a permit for construction of a building in the middle of a proposed highway?
There's proposed highways and roadways all over the city urban plans for every city in this state. Some of those are long term. They haven't been funded. You don't have any money to write a check to the people if you deny them a permit. And if you deny them a permit, as held in Teague and the...
What I'm saying is some kind of notice, some kind of actual notice. Okay, we'll issue you this permit, but you should be aware that we may be condemning this property. There is a proposed highway to go right through here. We may never build it, but then we may build it. If you want to you roll the dice and go ahead and put your building up there, that's your call, but you've got some notice.
Well, it's my position, and I think the law and the courts of this state and other states have upheld the fact that there is no absolute obligation to do that. That's a pretty heavy burden to put late, passed down to clerical levels and so forth in some regards of cities and counties across this country. If the court wants to do that, then I suspect the court is going to be overturning extremely, extremely entrenched public policy and many case laws in this state.
But as a practical matter, who is better able to know what's out there? The entity that's in control of it? Or?
I think that to answer that question in fairness, Your Honor, it's a balancing issue. First of all, as here, the development was hot and heavy in this community in 84 and 85, and the city, at some levels, is very capable of knowing, assuming they have some stability and employment, of what's in their plans. But they're looking at thousands, and it's sometimes tens of thousands in some large cities, projects based on comprehensive plans. When a private developer is looking at one site, one project, they hire engineers, they hire architects, they hire experts, and they're looking at one issue. They know where those plans are. They know they're there. They know they're on notice. So they're able to protect themselves very strongly because they can concentrate on one piece of property rather than putting the burden on the public to warn these people, or the public bearing all the cost of not warning. How do you distinguish that from not telling this developer in some sense about some obscure state law that may cause him trouble?
Mr. Knight, you state that the architect of Westgate Limited and their party, the investors, was well aware and testified in the trial court that he was aware of the proposed highway plan?
He was aware of the Austin Municipal Roadway Plan yesterday where this project was listed on it. No one was aware at that immediate time, or at least at the staff and their level, that it was about to become real.
In a supplemental brief, would you cite for me where in the record puts your case in the best light as far as architect's knowledge is concerned?
Yes, sir. I will reemphasize it. It is included in the briefs that we put in. Of course, they're voluminous.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. McLeish, when was the aerial photo made, and when was the proposed right-of-way drawn on that
The trial evidence was that the photographs were taken on May the 20th, 1985. It was uncertain as to exactly when this part of the drawing was done, Your Honor, because that's something that took place over about 3 weeks. There was a meeting between the state and the city and the private engineering consulting firm to put these lines on the ground. And they showed them to the city of Austin and the state of Texas on June 25th, 1985. That was the trial evidence on those 2 days.
Could you address specifically the city's argument, which I think can be crassly boiled down to, if you'd had a smart architect, you wouldn't be in this mess?
That argument is totally outside of the record in this case, Your Honor, and I must address it. The city's attorney at the trial on several occasions insinuated through my witnesses that the Austin Transportation Plan had this drawing on it. If my clients had gone to look at it, they would have known. My architect said he knew of the plan. He didn't think this roadway plan was on there, but he wasn't sure. He did not know. So he never produced the plan. They never tendered it into evidence. They never put a witness up there to say, this was on the plan, and if you'd have looked at it, you would have known. An argument to the contrary, I assure you, is outside of the record in this case. And I do need to make all the members of the court aware of the fact I believe that is very, very clear to the record. I will look at it again and respond with sincerest apologies to the court and the opposing counsel if that's incorrect. But I feel very certain that there was no evidence produced by anybody who knew what was in that plan that said this, it would put a purchaser on knowledge of this.
Counsel, I'm trying to recall, if I recall correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, opposing counsel said that the decision to proceed with this construction was brought before the council, taken under consideration by the city, in March of 1985. Is that when they first substantively considered this particular phase of the project?
There are a whole set of memos between the state and the city.
February 1985, though, was the initial date according to what he said.
Between the state and the city started back in December of 1985.
I'm talking about considered by the council.
The city council approved execution of the contract to acquire the right-of-way to build this road on March the 25th, 1985, and that contract is in the evidence in this case.
And your permit was issued in March of 1985.
Our
timely issued.
Our permit to build was issued, the evidence shows, on April 1st, 1985, and my client broke ground the next day.
You made that decision in March. Your permit was issued in April. This schematic was available in May.
This schematic was not available in May, or I can't represent that to you. The earliest date I can know for sure that this drawing with the lines on it, the photograph is certainly available in May. I can't represent
When did your clients receive actual notice? They got their permit in April, started construction the next day. Were they actually aware of the city's intent to move on this property?
The trial evidence was undisputed that they first found out about it when they read it in the paper on October the 20th, 1985.
When did you have constructive notice?
There was no evidence at trial to show that they could have possibly gotten notice of this project before that time. No evidence that anything would have happened before that time would have put them on evidence.
During what period of time was there debate between the city and the state as to whether landowners should be warned about this? You made reference to that in your opening argument.
The first memo that directly addresses it was dated January the 7th, 1985. They finally made the conclusion that they wouldn't tell people because they didn't have funds immediately available. It was last week in March, it's my recollection. It was March 25th, Your Honor.
Counsel, something neither of you has addressed so far is the question of the broad form issue as opposed to the separate jury questions on pre- and post-taking values. Probably should be addressed before everybody takes your seat.
I don't know if any of you all have ever tried a condemnation case. This was a real backward case for me as a condemnation lawyer, because the state's appraiser, the state's evidence in this case, was $1.5 million higher than mine in the before scenario, and about $2.5 million higher than mine in the after scenario. And reading the decision of the court in Callejo, it says the jury is not free to go outside of the evidence that the experts tender, and they're not free to mix before values and after values to come up with a number. On that set of the facts, we were very fearful of submitting one issue to the jury about what's the difference. Could come up with any sort of a verdict. It could come up with anything between $500,000 and $4 million. And the only range of evidence that the trial court, and I obviously asking him wrongly according to court appeals, the only range of the evidence we thought was correct was between $1.7 million and about $2.6 million, $2.6 million and a half. And the trial court was of the impression that submit the question separately like this would be the only way to really comply with what he felt was real holding in KL. That's the reason that we submitted two questions instead of one.
Yes. Interference does not have to be physical, and delay can be material. Won't there be that issue in every condemnation case?
Sure, I hope. I hope.
There's no legal reason why there wouldn't.
I hope that the facts are such that I hope that the state of Crete will treat other owners better, but you have to take this in the context of the way the trial court saw it when he made the determination to let the issue go to the jury. It wasn't just one.
But how can you keep it from going to the jury? I mean, it's going to be a jury issue in every case, it seems. There'll be inevitable delays. Nothing can be done instantly. And
that's right.
The government argues that some of these delays are due to open government rules. So is there any way to avoid this issue arising in virtually every case?
The way to avoid this case from coming back before the court is when the government recognizes the hardship and promises the landowner repeatedly, promises him that they will take his property expeditiously, but they come through on his promise.
My question, though, in view of the time that your time has expired, as I asked counsel earlier, my question to you simply, though, is there any way to avoid this legal issue in every condemnation case?
Put temporary partial takings, the issue of whether there's been a taking, back into the hands of the judge and take it out of the jury. That's my solution to it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for this morning. Foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.